there's a sense in many physicians' minds that they don't really want to be involved in the end-of-life management. It was credited to Woody Allen, that statement that, you know, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. And I think the doctors have the sense that, well, yeah, I can probably manage pain and other distressing symptoms, but I don't want to be the one in charge of the case when this patient dies.
Welcome to Transcending Home Care. Stan Massey of Transcend Strategy Group holds vital discussions with other experts on insights and ideas to help providers succeed in the ever-changing landscape of home-based healthcare. For more than 18 years now, Stan has helped providers of home-based care build their brands to increase referrals, admissions, patient days, and performance scores. Physicians play a crucial role in referring patients to other providers throughout the continuum of care. Yet there can be barriers in getting physicians' referrals to hospice, palliative care, and even certain services in home health. This episode features a conversation with a physician well-versed in these matters. Special guest, Michael Poletta, MD. Dr. Poletta is also a distinguished fellow of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine and serves as a Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for Hospice of Michigan, the largest provider of hospice and palliative care in that state. Overseeing care for more than 1,100 patients each day gives Dr. Poletta a distinct perspective on the physician mindset and keys to changing attitudes for breaking down barriers to referrals.
Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Poletta. You are the first physician we've had as a guest, and we know that the physician perspective is really important, especially as a referral source. So we really appreciate you joining us today.
I'm glad to have the opportunity. Thanks, Stan. And I think it's important for all of us who work in this industry to get the word out and to help to offset some of the misconceptions that hamper our specialty and some of the beliefs and attitudes that not only the referring doctors or healthcare people have about end-of-life care, palliative care, and hospice, but also the general public. You know, I think the number one challenge that we have is overcoming people's firm belief that what they know is such, and it's wrong or it's inaccurate or it's outdated. And to the extent that we can acknowledge that and get good information into people's hands so they can make informed choices, I think we have that responsibility. So I'm glad for the chance to do it.
Well said, and thanks again. One of the sad facts about hospice is that I would say most people, and I think statistically most patients, come on to the service much later than they should. And even families say, we really wish we would have called hospice sooner once they discover all the great benefits that hospice provides to both the patient and the whole family. Physician referrals are so important. And with that being said, what do you think are some of the biggest barriers to physicians referring patients to hospice care, especially as early as they should?
I think there are several factors that contribute to that. And one of them is what I would call patients and families having buyer's remorse on healthcare services. And if you think about it, there are billion-dollar marketing and advertising campaigns out in our communities about health systems and medical care, and every health system claims to be the one who can cure you when others can't. And every medical facility claims that they're the best and that they have the answers to people's health problems. And the patients and families, the people in the public in general, are to be forgiven if they buy into that very carefully crafted message that, hey, it's a matter of finding the right doctor, the right hospital, and you too can have your illness, your injury, your lifestyle problems reversed. And so they go in whole hog for surgery, for chemotherapy, for whatever other treatments are being offered. And as often happens, the medical problem is not really amenable to treatment past a certain point. And yet the desire to be cured is so powerful, and it's so reinforced by the societal messages that people just cannot give up trying something else. They're chasing a cure that doesn't exist. And they've completely bought into the idea that they can be restored to health. And when it finally dawns on them that that wasn't going to happen and that the cure wasn't there and that they wasted a lot of time and treasure chasing this elusive remedy, then they feel betrayed and they feel a little angry. And that's when I think we hear from people who say, well, you know, if I had known what was going to happen, we never would have had that operation. Or if we had known what chemotherapy was like, my dad would never have agreed. And they only come to that realization after the fact. So some of the challenge that we see is to get some of that information into people's hands and into their minds in advance so that they can make reasoned decisions about choosing a course of action. And it's a hard thing because people don't want to give it up. And it's a perfectly human response to bad medical news to say, you know, I want the best and brightest. Give me every shot that I have. But I think that buyer's remorse, I think the idea that we buy into the idea that health, that medicine and healthcare can cure our ills is so powerful that it just takes a long time and takes a toll on people before they start to look for something else.
Understood. That is a really good explanation of the buyer's remorse aspect. One of the things that we've seen with studies is that sometimes physicians also are not wanting to quote unquote give up on the patient, and they would really like to keep trying curative treatment. There was a study done by Harvard physician and researcher Nicholas Christakis that in that study in particular, it showed statistically that physicians overestimated life expectancy by an average of 526%. Now, that's not dissing doctors at all, because it becomes harder and harder to be accurate with life prognosis. But with 6 months being a major guideline for hospice referrals, tell us some challenges you've seen as a physician in accurately predicting life expectancy with today's advanced medical interventions.
Well, there are a couple of thoughts that occur to me as I hear your question. The Christakis pronouncement, if we could call it that, you know, that body of work is very well known in palliative care and hospice circles. Our own anecdotal experiences reinforce that notion. And it's a very common thing for us to be at the bedside or in the home of a seriously ill person. And our experienced clinicians, just looking at the patient, examining, knowing the sequence of events that have brought us to this place, will say to the family, you know, they say, Doc, how long do we have? We say, well, I think we're looking at hours to days. You know, mom's feet are purple. You know, she's breathing once every 40 seconds. I think we're very close. And the family has this look of bewilderment. And they said, well, we don't understand because, you know, Dr. Jones told us that she had, you know, 9 months to a year last week. So that phenomenon is very, very common. And I don't think that it's the doctors have any malice or that they're misleading people. I think that, you know, it does underscore the difficulty in prognosticating serious illness. A second piece of that is that the six-month prognosis has really become a barrier. It was chosen way back in the 1980s when the Medicare hospice benefit was first being considered, and they had to make a decision on how long and how inclusive the benefit should be. And they didn't have good data in 1982 to really judge or to answer that question. And so what they said is, well, the people who are most likely to know that they have a short prognosis are cancer patients. And so they looked at some analyses of cancer patient survival, and they found that, you know, the most common the median survival seemed to be around 6 months. And so they said, hey, let's pick 6 months. And off they went with a 6 month or less prognosis. And in reality, not only are most patients in hospice in 2019, not cancer patients. But it's also true that there's nothing magic about the six-month prognostic marker, and that if a patient survives longer than 6 months on hospice, nothing happens, except that the hospice provider must continue to evaluate likely prognosis and continue to certify that if the illness runs its expected course, that the prognosis is shortened. So for physicians in the community or for people looking at their own decisions on choosing a healthcare path, if they believe that something awful happens at the six-month mark, so you know, we better make sure that we don't overshoot that. So they wait and wait and wait. It really is it's not a useful marker anymore. Yet it's so ingrained in people's thinking, the 6 months or less, 6 months or less, that people just can't shake it. And we try to say, why don't you think about 6 to 12 months? Because it's really a common thing for patients in hospice to last longer than 180 days. And yet, the vast majority will die within a year. And so it's that between 6 and 12 months is really a better target that fits the circumstances of many terminally ill patients. But we're overcoming, you know, 25 years of 6 months or less, 6 months or less. So that's another aspect of that. And then I think the last piece, as far as physicians not wanting to make the referral, I think that there's some dissonance on the physician's part too. And the doctors that may have been caring for this person for years in many cases, and they don't want that person to feel either that the doctor is abandoning them or has a situation that the doctor can't handle. So when they make a referral to a hospice program, you're in their own mind, they're saying to the patient, I'm giving up on you. I can't handle the problems that you have anymore, and I'm done with it. Good luck, and these people will take care of you. And they're really loath to send that kind of a message to a valued patient. I also think that there's a sense in many physicians' minds that they don't really want to be involved in the end-of-life management. You know, I think it was credited to Woody Allen, that statement that, you know, I'm not afraid of dying. I just don't want to be there when it happens. And I think the doctors have the sense that, well, yeah, I can probably manage pain and other distressing symptoms, but I don't want to be the one in charge of the case when this patient dies. I'm perfectly okay if somebody else is at the steering wheel when that occurs. So the physicians themselves are a little bit torn between the loyalty to their patient and wanting to provide the best for them and not feeling comfortable being in charge of the management at the very end, and particularly at the time of death. So, you know, to the extent that they can reconcile that conflict for themselves, they're either going to refer to hospice late or not at all. Or, you know, if they've managed to resolve that conflict, then they can be a little more circumspect in how they view the prognosis and the advice that they give to the patient.
That insight is really helpful. And I love that Woody Allen quote. You've given a couple of really good pointers in your last answer. What do you feel are the keys to removing or reducing the barriers we've talked about so far and encouraging physicians to consider hospice care as early as appropriate?
Some of the remaining barriers that we have to overcome, one of them is a lot of misconception, not only in the public, but also among physicians, about the limits of hospice and palliative care. The popular misconception is that once a patient is referred to hospice, all medical care ceases, the medications are stopped, the treatments are ended. Oh yes, you know, we put you on morphine and kick you to the curb, and then some days later you die. And that's what people believe happens in hospice. And so when they say, I'm not ready for hospice, they're saying, I'm not ready to have you take all of my treatments and medicines away and kick me to the curb on morphine until I die. Well, I wouldn't be ready for that either. So if we can get the word out to the community and to the doctors that hospice and palliative care sometimes follow very aggressive treatment programs, and treating pain and other distressing symptoms at the end of life requires a lot of management. And we stop medications that no longer have value, but we add as many treatments as we subtract. And sometimes the treatments that we add are new medications, very sophisticated, very technologically advanced treatments and medications that we use to provide comfort at the end of life. And people just, you know, they're shocked when they find out some of the things that we do because they bought into the old kick me to the curb notion. It's not that medical care stops. It's just that we change tactics and we stop pretending that we can cure this cancer that's ravaged your body and instead say, we can control your pain. We can make you comfortable and you can still be wide awake so you can enjoy your family and your hobbies right up to the end. And, you know, we can do a lot of things with managing your symptoms and helping you with spiritual care and connecting your family and helping you with financial issues and all kinds of things that we do in hospice care that people don't know about. Those are the things that you're signing up for when you sign up for hospice. So instead of giving up, you're just changing tactics and you're preparing yourself for a natural, controlled, dignified end of life. And you're taking a lot of burden off of your family about difficult decisions and other things. So we need to get that message out so that people know exactly what it is they're saying yes to or saying no to when they're evaluating hospice care. I think another barrier that remains in the minds of physicians, kind of along the same lines, is that the doctors not understanding what hospice professionals actually do. We actually have a lot of fairly sophisticated ways of dealing with distressing symptoms at the end of life, and that, you know, we can manage some problems that they may not be comfortable with. And in the same way that a doctor in the community has respect for the skill set that a cardiologist or a pulmonologist or a kidney specialist brings, and they don't feel bad that a cardiologist knows things and does things that they don't know, they welcome the cardiologist as a team member in helping them care for the total patient. We need to get our brother and sister doctors viewing the palliative care and the hospice physician in the same way, that we have a skill set and we have an experience and a research and information base that they don't have, and that we should be a member of their team providing comprehensive care to their patient in the same way that the heart specialist is. And when we get closer to that, I think you'll see the late referrals, and I think you'll see some of the barriers to referrals start to come down.
That makes total sense. A couple of times you were referring to palliative care truly as its own specialty apart from hospice care. And we've always seen with our clients that offer both hospice and palliative care services some frustration because they think that palliative care should be so attractive because you remove the talk about death and dying that you have with hospice. You can have palliative care in conjunction with curative treatment. So there's some frustration that physicians don't refer to palliative care as often as they should. In fact, there was also another well-known study that was done by the Center to Advance Palliative Care that asked physicians point blank if they distinguished between hospice and palliative care, and most of them readily admitted that they did not distinguish, that they considered palliative care as being comfort care for the last days of life. You just beautifully described a lot of the benefits in pain and symptom control. So what do you think are some of the keys to helping physicians understand and appreciate the difference between palliative care and hospice care?
I think that the differences between palliative care and hospice are bewildering for a lot of folks. And there's some interesting twists to it. The first is that hospice care really, in the minds of the public and the professions, came first because the Medicare hospice benefit was legislated and came into being in the 1980s. And so it's been around for some decades. And it's only in the last 10 years or so that palliative care has been a thing that people talk about. But in reality, palliative care is the parent and hospice is the child. And by that, I mean that the palliative care is the larger philosophy and strategy of management. It drops the pretense of cure and acknowledges that there are just medical conditions that even with all the technology that we have and the advances that we've made, there are some things that just cannot be cured. And to continue to chase a cure is counterproductive. And so palliative care says, what if we switch our focus from curing to coping with a chronic illness, managing symptoms the best that we can manage, and helping people learn to live with an advanced disease and get the absolute most value and quality of life out of whatever time they have left. So if you think about geriatric medicine and the care of older adults, that's really palliative care, because we don't cure diabetes. We don't cure heart disease or hypertension. We don't cure arthritis. We try to help older adults learn how to live and how to have quality of life in spite of those chronic conditions. So all of adult medicine, geriatrics is really palliative. And other than some pneumonias and bladder infections and a few other things, we don't cure a whole lot in adult medicine. And so this idea of palliative care focused not on eradicating the disease from the body, but in controlling it, making the person less miserable, and helping them to learn how to live as well as they can with a chronic condition, that's what palliative care is. And so it's really not a stretch to sell that as an approach to care that acknowledges the limitations of what medical science can actually promise. So we can't cure arthritis, but we can help you to learn to live with it. And we can't cure diabetes or heart disease yet, but we can show you how to have a high quality of life despite those conditions. And all of that should be clear and should be celebrated and should be promoted. And then hospice is just that little subset of palliative care that says not only we can't cure, but we can also see on the horizon that you have a limited lifespan. But there's still a lot that we can do to improve quality of life and help you with a controlled, dignified end of your life and leave positive legacy for others. Another aspect that plays into it, I think, is that my opinion is that the younger generation of physicians, the guys and gals that are training in medicine now, are much more aware and are receiving instruction and experience in palliative care and hospice. And so we're graduating now a generation of doctors who think very naturally about palliative care and hospice, and they see how it fits into the continuum of care. As the gray hairs go away and retire, move out of the workforce, and are replaced by younger physicians with more recent and more up-to-date training, I think physician attitudes will change markedly. And the practitioners will make better earlier referrals, and it will be perfectly natural to them because they've been trained that way. So I'm hopeful for the future. I think it's going to get better.
I certainly hope you're right about that too. That was a really interesting perspective. And speaking of both younger physicians and established physicians, today's medicine is so evidence-based. What kind of evidence-based reporting on hospice and palliative care do you think would be most meaningful to physicians, especially with hospice care where the ultimate outcome is death, even if it's a good death?
I think the evidence that would be most meaningful for physicians, probably in a couple different areas. One is, I think we need to talk more about the studies that have shown patients who follow a combined strategy of palliative care and disease-directed management at the same time do better, live longer, and have a more controlled, not only a longer survival, but then they have a better end-of-life experience. And there have been a number of different studies where the cancer treatments continued and they also had palliative care teams working with them earlier. One of the positive events that occurred several years ago was when ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, acting upon some studies that their members had done, came out with a policy statement and said, you know, brother and sister oncologists out there, you need to be including palliative care earlier in the course of managing your cancer patients. And it became, you know, when a professional society like that comes out with a position, it becomes part of the standard of practice. And so cancer docs were put on notice that to not refer to palliative care or to refer very late and to not be using hospice services is bad medicine. And it's actually, it's now becoming the standard of practice to have early referral to palliative teams. So that was huge. And it wasn't the palliative care and hospice world saying, look how great we are. It was the cancer physician organization saying, this is an important part of our management. So that kind of evidence that leads to professional societies amending the standards of practice will be huge. And as that continues to happen, I think the doctors will pay attention. The other thing that we should be talking more about is the body of work that shows that those patients do live longer and they live better. And it's from the standpoint of the patients and families themselves. If people knew that by pursuing palliative care early in the course and using hospice services at the appropriate time, that they would live longer, they would have better control of their symptoms, they would have an improved quality of life, and their surviving family members would feel better about the care that was given to their loved one, no one would say no to that. But that message isn't out there yet. And to the extent that we can convince the public that, yes, when you have a medical problem, you should pursue all of the treatment that's available to you. Modern medical science does mind-boggling things compared to what our grandfathers knew. And you should take advantage of all the care that you can get. But when it's obvious that the treatments are not helping, and when it's obvious that you need to make changes in your lifestyle because of illness, choosing these strategies of palliative care and hospice is a way to improve your life and bring a lot of quality and benefit, not only to you, but to your family and your loved ones. That when that message sinks in and people figure that out on their own, then I think we're going to see improvement.
I think you're exactly right. When the public does understand the importance of hospice and palliative care, it will be a game changer. In your last response, you were talking about the importance of the oncologists letting their peers know that the inclusion of hospice and palliative care was good medicine. On the same note, how influential is peer-to-peer recommendations among physicians, and how can an agency's medical director better interact with physicians to encourage referrals?
What I like to tell my physicians and our young doctors in training who go through our program is that the most powerful tool you have to promote our discipline, our industry, our philosophy of care is the old-fashioned telephone. And you pick up that phone and you call the referring doctor and you say, hey, Greg, this is Mike. And I've got Mildred Jones here that you know very well, and she's been referred to us. And I want to talk to you about her transfusion schedule and the fact that, you know, the interval between transfusions is getting shorter and shorter and putting more and more of a burden on her. And, you know, let's talk about what we should do together going forward to take care of her. The fact that we're having that conversation about a specific patient is meaningful and valuable to him, but it sends another message in that, and I'm revisiting the concept that I mentioned earlier, which was, I'm not kicking her to the curb. I'm not stopping all of her treatments. I'm not putting her on morphine and 3 days later she's going to be dead. I'm looking at continuing her transfusions in a way that makes sense medically, that will meet her goals as a patient, will satisfy you as her doctor that she's receiving appropriate care, and we're doing this together in an absolute model of collaborative care planning. And all of that from just picking up the phone and talking for a few minutes. And I don't think we do enough of that. I think that we rely on technology, we rely on indirect things, you know, emails and other ways of communicating and reviewing of records. And all those things are important. But when you get right down to it, It's the doctors putting their heads together and deciding what makes sense for this patient at this point in the illness is a very powerful tool that we need to take better advantage of. And I say that to patients when they ask about some treatment or some course of action that they want to pursue, whether I think it's ill-advised or potentially helpful. What I say to them is, I'm going to call your doctor, you know, the doctor who knows you the best and the doctor who knows what's likely to be helpful going forward. And we're going to come up with a plan of care that makes sense for you. I find that to be a very powerful statement that convinces people that we're taking their best interests in mind, and we're not just stopping things to either save money for an insurance company or because we've given up, and that's why some of these medications ought to go away, that no, we're collaborating on a care plan, and we're getting rid of things that are not helpful and adding things that are going to be useful. And I think that that's what people expect their doctors to do. That's what referring doctors expect their consultants to do. And that's what we need to do more of. So I think that direct communication is an underutilized tool. And to the extent that we can be successful there, we're teaching at the same time we're sending a positive message on the care plan.
Very good advice. Is there any additional advice that you would give to providers for educating physicians on the advantages of hospice and palliative care and overcoming barriers to referrals that we haven't talked about already?
An interesting thing that came out not long ago, and it was an article, I saw the article, I think, in the Wall Street Journal, and they the researchers talked about what physicians do for themselves and their family members in the face of advanced illness versus the advice that they gave to their patients. And I don't remember the actual study design in detail, but basically the message was when doctors get sick or their family gets sick, and I don't mean just get sick, they have a serious medical problem, they use hospice and palliative medicine to a very high proportion. And that is in distinction to the advice that they give their patients, where they're not referring for palliative care and hospice in anywhere near the proportion that they do for their own. And so the question that we're entitled to ask is, when they know that it's their own neck or their someone that they love, they choose palliative care and hospice because they know that, you know, more cancer treatment is not going to be beneficial, or another surgery is not going to be helpful. Yet when they have a patient in front of them and the patient asks about cancer treatment or about surgery, the doctors are reluctant to discourage them. And so what we need is we need physicians giving their patients the same advice that they give their brother-in-law in terms of what's useful, what's not likely to be helpful, and what you should really do going forward. And I think that there are probably going to be other researchers who pick up on that thread and study the behavior of physicians and their referral patterns and say, we need doctors, advising their customers the same way they advise their family. And there are probably a number of factors that contribute to that in what patients and families expect, in what's possible within health systems and so on. But I was just amused, and I'm sure a lot of people were amused by that. You know, doctors choose palliative care and hospice for themselves far more often than they recommend it for their patients. And why is that? So,
wow. I think that is very interesting and a very strong note to end on. Dr. Paletta, thank you so much for taking your time to share your experience and your insights with us today. We know it's really important to look at the physician's perspective, and we really appreciate hearing insights from a physician. Thanks for your time again today, and hope you'll join us again some other time.
It's a privilege to take care of these patients and their families, and it's a duty to spread the word and try to get good information out there. So I'm happy for that opportunity. Thank you for that, and we'll talk again somewhere down the road.
Thanks for listening. Watch for future episodes of Transcending Home Care on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcast. For more content, visit transcendgroup.consulting.